Hello everyone, Space Cafe Podcast, Marcus here. So, it's episode number 5 already, and it's the first episode after the successful Crew Dragon mission. Elon did it again in the most elegant manner possible. Yet, rocket launches are still nerve-wrenching to me at least. It's almost impossible for me to watch them, to be super honest. Not for their sheer massiveness and intensity, but also for their proneness to catastrophe. But really? Is spaceflight really that dangerous? Perhaps it's just my feeble human bias. So, let's commit to statistics. I dug a little around on the internet. Of the total number of orbital launches, only 5.8% were a failure. That means that 94% of all space flights that have ever happened have been successful so far. That is uplifting. It will most likely not result in lesser drama during the next manned mission on my side, though. Today with me on the show is a guy they call the Elon of Singapore. Charismatic young man who wants nothing less than take on the big guys. He claims to have a secret rocket technology that will give him an edge over the Elons of this age. Big words from a humble mouth. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome the CEO and founder of Equatorial Space Systems, Simon, and his unpronounceable last name.
I know what you're getting at.
I'd suggest let's do the pronunciation game.
Sure.
Please tell me, how do I pronounce your last name?
Yeah, so the correct way is Gwóźdź, but I don't really expect anyone who doesn't speak Polish to know how to pronounce it, accurately. It is a pretty interesting surname, even for, Polish language. So
Gwóźdź. So say it again.
Gwóźdź, yeah, you got it pretty right, yeah.
Simon, what made you leave your native country?
Right. I actually moved to Singapore when I was a teenager with my family. So I basically migrated here, and I've been living here for most of my life now. So partly one of the reasons was that I spent quite a bit of time in Southeast Asia when I was a kid, and together with my family, and we basically liked the vibe, the atmosphere, the food, and of course, and the weather is definitely better than in Poland, especially come October or November. So yeah, basically decided to relocate over here. One thing led to another. In the end, I converted my citizenship and I basically settled down. So that's how I became a Singapore citizen, really.
Wow. I have a question. When I did my research on you, and of course, yep, dear listeners, this is the fun part of my work here. I get to know extremely interesting people, and Simon is one of them. And when I did my research, of course, I took a look at Facebook, and I found a Facebook update dating back to the 18th of March.
The fateful day.
And it has a update reading chaotic neutral and then patient 271. So please do tell me, what was this all about?
This chaotic neutral thing is more of a running joke between some of my friends and myself that dates way back. But the more interesting thing would be the patient 271, because I actually contracted COVID myself.
No.
Yeah, I did. I actually did it, and I was in the hospital for
3 weeks.
No,
you're kidding. Seriously, you're the first I personally get to know who contracted COVID-19. Seriously,
yep.
Wow.
Yep, so this is the first time for everything, I suppose. So I was actually in London. That's the leading theory that I probably picked it up during one of the events that I went to in March. And I flew back. I felt okay for a week. Then I started getting some sore throat and a bit of a runny nose. And I decided to get checked, since I've exposed my entire team at Equatorial Space. And luckily, none of them actually caught it. Some of them got tested after I was hospitalized.
And, because you keep professional distance.
Of course. But we did gym with a couple of them together. So I was actually really scared, because we were sharing weights and the same equipment. And I was a little concerned, so that's why I decided to get checked. And long story short, it was a very mild case, but before I was fully cleared, It took 3 weeks, so it was quite an adventure.
Wow, not recommended. But is it all good now?
I was already pretty good after the first 2 days or so. So I didn't really take any like, you know, medicating to get me sorted out. And yeah, essentially I was still testing positive until like 3 weeks later. But I was actually feeling all right, so nothing to worry.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'm so glad you made it through all that horror.
Oh, thanks. Thank you so much. The biggest horror was really not knowing how long am I going to stay there. I made a friend because at first I was in isolation ward, and I was moved to like a shared ward with a couple other people. And I made this friend who was altogether, he was there for over a month. More than a month. I think more like 5 weeks, actually, which is pretty crazy. So, yeah, I got away with, you know, with minimum damages done. Yeah.
Good to hear.
Yep. Thanks.
Thanks for that wonderful, horrible story.
Oh, thanks. No worries.
All right. This guy collects impressive chapters for his biography. And what you just heard is just the beginning. This I can already tell you. On with the show.
Simon, before we move on, let's go back in history. What I can already say, dear listeners, Simon is labeled as the CEO of SpaceX of Singapore. This is what people say about you, Simon, and your company, Equatorial Space Systems. Before we get there, how did it all come together? How did everything start?
You know, as cheesy as it sounds, I think everybody has a phase when they are fascinated by spaceflight in their lives, especially when they're children. In my case, I refused to grow up fully until now. And I really blame Ron Howard and Tom Hanks, because Apollo 13 was my jam when I was like 5 or 6 years old.
Okay, here's we've had a problem here.
Fine, guidance.
Go, guidance.
We've had a hardware restart. I don't know what it was.
Okay.
Houston, we've had a problem. We've had a main bus undervolt.
Before we move on, the soundbite you just heard was not from the movie, but taken from the original radio communication from back in 1970. And if you have some time to spare later today, please cancel all your appointments, lock yourself up in a spaceship, and go to apolloinrealtime.org to relive the dramatic mission. An ingenious piece of work. Thank you, Internet. On with the show.
And I was just watching that on a repeat. I was looping that thing over and over and over again. And I just couldn't stop picturing myself in a mission control room at some point. You know, Ed Harris's character, you know, playing Gene Kranz, was just such a powerful presence in there. And that was really an inspiration for me since my earliest memories. So I knew that eventually I want to get involved with spaceflight in one way or another. So when I moved to Singapore, there was not much going on in commercial space. A couple of research groups and government institutions were working on satellites, but there was absolutely nothing being done about a launch segment. So that's what I could already see. There was some talk about this Space Adventures initiative. They were thinking of building a suborbital launch center in next to Changi Airport. I'm not exactly sure what went wrong. But yeah, I basically, you know, I was going through the day-to-day, you know, activities and emotions and sitting on through my exams and doing my military service for 2 years, which was just not my favorite.
So let me just jump in here. When you were playing... Simon, let me just jump in here. When you were playing with those thoughts, how old were you back then?
Yeah, so it never really left me. So I got to Singapore when I was 15, right? I'm almost 30 now, so... So essentially, I was quite preoccupied with my, you know, studies and my exams and all of that normal standard stuff. Then I went to the military, and around the same time, I basically started to get back to the old ideas. And when I started university 2 years later, I decided to connect with the local ecosystem that was working on commercial space technologies. And at the same time, I began to self-study things like orbital mechanics, different kinds of propulsion architectures.
Say that again. Self-study.
Yeah, I mean,
seriously.
It's okay. If It was just Newtonian model at that point, so it wasn't that complicated.
You know. Sure, what else would you do in your spare time? Of course, yeah, exactly. Self-study Newtonian mechanics and space travel.
Well, that sounds perfectly reasonable to me. Basically, I got those two things going on concurrently. I was going through some of the theory about spacecraft systems engineering so I can understand what the hell is going on. And at the same time, I was talking to people during those events locally and regionally who are actually building it. And I got to find out what their pain points are, what would they like to see from a launch vehicle, what are the limitations of current systems, and only then I realized that satellites are actually getting really small. I was not fully familiar with small sats before that point, which is roughly 5 years ago. And this interest in commercial space tech of the era, coupled with that youthful passion, which I always had, and it never really went away, just morphed itself into what became Equatorial Space. And I roped in some friends, and we started working on very basic prototypes of hybrid rockets, and things got progressively more and more serious until we basically got one of the top engineers in hybrid propulsion technology in the world as our CTO.
Hold on, Simon. Was it somewhat a young boy's rocket dream and you build your own thing in your mom's kitchen?
Well, I tried. She wasn't very happy. Of course, there's a factor to that, on a personal level. But most importantly, rockets are essentially a transportation, piece of transportation infrastructure. And even though launch segment only accounts for a couple percent of the entire value chain of space technologies, nothing else can exist without it. And the limitations pertaining to reliability, affordability, types of orbits which are actually accessible by existing products, it's all affecting the entire supply chain, actually, the entire value chain of space tech. And of course, yes, there is this idealistic part about this, the passion of doing this, but we see a very clear need for better launch technology and better launch systems. So that's why we still do what we do on a full-time basis rather than just as hobbyists. So I would like to just set the record clear in that sense.
So how big is the company?
Yeah, so we have a full-time staff of 6 people right now, and we do have quite a number of volunteers who are both university students and also some of senior industry professionals as well. So altogether, we have a team of 17 folks right now.
Wow. So what is your elevator pitch when you want to get someone on board?
Well,
or when you want money?
So that's quite a different pitch between those two. When I want to rope someone in, very easy. Imagine yourself standing not far from a rocket engine during a ground test. Once you hear that sound, there is no turning back. It's just, once you get a choke flow situation and once you hear that entire blast wave reaching you, it's...
I envy you so much. The closest I got to rockets was during New Year's.
Okay.
But this is...
Hey, you have,
so I envy you so much.
You have a standing invitation to one of our tests when the time is right.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Before we proceed, please listen with me to what Simon means when he says that there is no turning back. Ladies and gentlemen, crank up your earphones and close your eyes if your environment allows for, and hold tight. And if you can tell me which spacecraft produces that sound, shoot me a message at podcast@spacewatch.global. We do not have merchandise yet, but wouldn't it be cool to be the first? Enough talk. Headphones ready? Go.
Sound suppression water system armed. T-minus 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4,
No words needed anymore, right?
And when it comes to elevator pitch to like prospective investors, well, you know, our technology can basically address 52% of failure modes which affect launch vehicles, both solid fuel systems and liquid fuel systems. In a typical hybrid, you don't get high-speed vortices to the same extent, so there's basically less chance of a failure during the entire operation of the engine. And at the same time, we don't use anything that's actually explosive in it, because it's not a composite propellant like HDPB and ammonium perchlorate. We use something which is very easy to make, very safe to store and transport, and it's fundamentally very straightforward. And this will help us reduce both the prices and the risk of launch operations. So that's the value which we can bring. And on top of all this, thanks to our location, we will be able to reach equatorial low Earth orbit.
Simon, whenever I'm watching SpaceX's launch, because I mean, like, this is mostly what's happening when it comes to global space launch coverage. It keeps giving me goosebumps whenever they are launching their rockets.
Oh, absolutely. I'm a huge fan.
Because it's such a dramatic moment. I was just watching it with my daughter. She's 11 years old.
All right.
And we were both close to tears just watching it, watching the power of everything. So why is it, Simon, so damn hard to launch a rocket? I mean, like, humanity has been doing it for almost half a century, and still it's so damn hard.
That's a whole Pandora's box. I mean, one thing is, of course, the technology, especially if you're working with liquid fuel propulsion systems. There's plenty of things that can go wrong. And it's not a very practical practical technology for companies with limited resources. If you're SpaceX, if you put $100 million into R&D, then sure, you can make it happen. But it's still pretty steep, and not many companies have that kind of money lying around. So that's one of the difficulties: the limitation of existing technologies. Another problem is, of course, regulatory and legal. Very few people think about how complicated it is to secure a launch permit, especially if you're trying to do it from a completely new place. You have to get the airspace authorities involved. You have to get the maritime authorities involved to make sure that the downrange is kept safe. You have to make sure that the rocket is licensed by your nation state, which is actually operating it. Even if it's a private company, there has to be due to the liability convention, there has to be responsibility.
And that is interesting. Yeah. So if I were to launch a rocket from Vienna, Austria, yeah, I would need the backing of the Austrian government for it.
You need a license, because this way the government essentially says, okay, you have your rocket. It's a privately built vehicle for a private satellite, but if you hit somebody or somebody else's satellite or any asset anywhere, you have to be held responsible. Or rather, the government has to be held responsible, because that's how the Outer Space Treaty from 1967, I believe it's 1967, yeah, might be getting the number off, but anyway. So essentially, a country that launches something is fundamentally responsible for it. So that's where the liability convention comes into place. A nation which certifies a vehicle to be ready for flight has to make sure that you have enough insurance coverage in case you cause some damage to somebody or something. So, the entire licensing process is a whole different thing.
So who's covering your insurance?
So this is a funny part, because Singapore does not have launch regulations in place yet, but we are discussing this with the Economic Development Board. So if this gets delayed by for any reasons, we will most likely do our first flights from Australia. I mean, we have to do our first flights from someplace that's already established.
So going back to the original question, why it is so damn hard to get into space, into orbit. So we covered the legal issues. We covered the propellant issues. What else is so difficult?
Yeah. So of course, propulsion system is like, it's the beating heart of a rocket, but rockets are very, very multidisciplinary, and they operate at peak performances. They cannot be too heavy, so they have to be very well engineered. And as a result, you have something that's essentially operating on the limits of material science. And that's one of the reasons why launch vehicles are not as reliable as aircraft just yet. They just cannot afford that degree of reliability for the same cost yet. I think that is going to happen eventually. Hopefully, we will have a part to play in that with our proprietary technology. But essentially, we were talking about integrating plenty of different things together. Structures, software, electronics, general hardware, flow control systems, of course, the propulsion itself, and the list goes on. So to successfully put together a launch vehicle is a non-trivial task. I don't think it will ever become a trivial task. And even if you simplify the propulsion system, there's still plenty of things that require very careful engineering. And they are not cheap or easy.
But say, Simon, what has changed that now an almost 30-year-old from Singapore can do it? Back in the day, only superpowers could do. So what is different?
Okay, I'll surprise you a little. You got the superpower part right, of course, but plenty of people involved in the Apollo program were actually pretty young. Of course, they had von Braun and the senior engineering team, and so do we, and so does every company. But they were actually supported by people who are quite often straight from college. So there is this misconception that spaceflight is reserved only for PhDs and people with gray hair. Not necessarily. Of course, they have their own place in senior positions. But the average age at the Apollo mission control room at the Apollo 11 landing was, I believe, 28. Right. So that's one thing. Now, regarding this, the other part of the question regarding the location and the superpower status. Well, so first of all, we have new material science. So access to materials is much easier now, and materials are getting better and also more affordable. We have access to personal computing, and that makes the entire design and simulation part incomparably easier than it was back in the day. We also have access to contemporary manufacturing methods, including 3D printing and generally additive manufacturing. And it's also been propagated all over the world in the last 20 years, and it made the entire challenge of assembling anything physical much easier. On top of this...
In addition, you can build on the shoulders of giants, because back in the day, the Apollo guys, they had to invent everything
absolutely.
From scratch. You can build on their technology.
I was about to say exactly that. We are standing on shoulders of giants, of people from Mercury, Apollo, from even, international space efforts, really. And the work that they've done, the research they've done and published, is really still the guiding light for all rocket initiatives, because otherwise we would still be trying to figure things out from scratch. And of course, there's a lot of design work which is done from scratch, and plenty of stuff is not easy to procure, especially on the guidance side, because it's again export restricted, including the technical information and software and all that. So there is some aspect of it that you still have to build from scratch, but the core knowledge is already established and well trailblazed by the giants who made lunar landings possible or made Sputnik 1 possible. So absolutely, we are riding on their accomplishments, and without their work and sacrifice and insane amount of effort, we would not be where we are today. That would simply be impossible.
Say, Simon, so now we learned how difficult it is to get into space, but you have a secret sauce that you are ready to compete with the big guys, with the SpaceX's of this generation. Yeah. So what makes you different, and how can you dare compete with Elon?
Okay, so let's take it one step at a time. We want to get into suborbit first, then we'll build a small satellite launcher to compete for in the small sat market. That's the somewhat lower hanging fruit, and then we'll think about going heavier. So it really has to be a gradual process. So what's different in this case, before we move back to the original question, is that the small sat market is so much it's so vastly greater than during the Falcon 1 missions. So that's why Rocket Lab can survive. That's why Virgin Orbit is close to already getting into the market and is also very well capitalized. And a couple of other companies are also very quite close to being orbital, including Relativity and Firefly, and a couple of them also in China. But anyway, back to the previous point. So what makes us special is really the propulsion system. Okay, so I'm not sure if you're familiar with how a hybrid rocket operates. Have you had any encounters with those before?
Please go ahead.
Okay.
Please go ahead and enlighten us.
All right, sure. So essentially, it's a simple thing that carries solid fuel and liquid oxidizer. So the solid fuel itself does not have oxidizer embedded into it, unlike a composite propellant, so there is no explosive risk from it. So it's safe.
So yeah. Solid fuel is like gunpowder.
No, not really. That would be a complete propellant, because that actually burns by itself. In a hybrid, you have to run oxidizer, which is stored in a liquid form, through the combustion chamber, and only then combustion can happen. So again, this is not a new concept. It's got lots of advantages. First of all, the safety, the simplicity compared to liquid fuel engines. It's flexible in a sense, you can throttle it and you can shut it down if something goes wrong, or you can restart it multiple times if you design for it. So it can be adapted to more than just, you know, boost phase of flight. But the problem with hybrids was always the solid fuel, the combustion characteristics of the solid fuel. If you take something very ordinary like HDPB rubber and you don't mix oxidizer into it, the regression rate, which is essentially the speed at which the whole thing burns, drops massively. And with the regression rate, you lose a lot of trust because the mass flow is nowhere near as high as it otherwise would have been. And that's why it basically becomes impractical for orbital launch. So conversely, some research groups started to experiment with paraffin wax in the last 20 years, which is still a very, very much the favorite of amateur rocketry groups, which are working on hybrids because of its accessibility and, degree of safety. But the issue with paraffin wax is that it's not stable. It doesn't bond into the housing very well. It basically just starts flying out uncombusted, and you can lose 10 to 15% of your fuel, which in case of an orbital launcher means that you're not making it into orbit, essentially. So what we've got is a solid fuel composition, which is very straightforward. It doesn't require a very complex geometry of that fuel, unlike some of the previous attempts. So we don't lose a lot of that material, you know, to poor combustion. And essentially, this is it. Solid fuel composition invented by our chief technical officer, Jamie Anderson, who spent 30 years developing rocket systems and spent good 10 years working on this solid fuel. And we've already tested it and it works. And it's getting us similar performances as a purely solid fuel system without any of the danger involved. So that's what we can do. And as a result, we'll be able to complete our R&D faster because plenty of that groundwork was already done. We avoid, as I mentioned before, 52% of reasons why rockets explode in the first place.
How many explosions have you seen so far in your own labs?
Oh, in our labs? No, none. You know, at worst, it will not ignite. But basically there is practically no risk of actual detonation with our technology, which is a huge step forward. Of course, there are some other things which can go wrong with the entire rocket, like, you know, the rocket flying in the wrong direction, so we have to take care of that as well. But starting from the propulsion unit is actually very important, because that determines how expensive and how complex and how risky the entire setup will end up in the end. So this is really what we have that's special. And even among companies which are working on hybrids, because we are not the only one, we are the only ones who have taken this very chemical approach to solving that problem. That was historically preventing hybrid propulsion from being practical for orbital launch operations.
Interesting. Fill us in a little where you are at right now from a development phase. So what, for a layperson, what do you already have and what's still needed? Do you have the thrusters? Do you have the rocket body, the hull?
Yeah, so we've done some testing on some ground testing of the solid fuel composition, and essentially it works as advertised. So that's out of the way. And recently we have built Southeast Asia first privately developed guided rocket, which is also pending flight from a test site which we've agreed to be in Malaysia. And we can't really travel right now because of the border closures, but we'll be flying this we call it low altitude demonstrator in the very, very near future, as early as we can basically get over across the border to Malaysia. This is, again, it's a non-trivial project, even though it's designed for modest altitudes. We have a complete guidance package, we have a telemetry feed, and we have, of course, a recovery system so we can refly it a couple of times and optimize our control gains, essentially. So on a very modest budget, we managed to build something that's essentially paving way for development of the future programs, because many of the building blocks will essentially be transplanted for the future projects.
All right. So, Simon, once you're through with everything, and you have your rocket ready and thrusters ready for countdown. So what is it that you would bring into space? So who is your customer?
Yeah, so I mean, generally, small-sat companies are still on the lookout for more launch opportunities. So we're talking companies such as, I mean, we are in touch with launch service integrators such as ExoLaunch, Precious Payload, Responsive Access over in the UK. And we're also in touch with individuals, companies which are developing satellites for various purposes, such as Open Cosmos and Transcelestial Technologies right here in Singapore. Essentially, anyone who's got a satellite under 100 kilograms could be our client. But we find we have specific interest from companies which are looking into putting satellites in equatorial low Earth orbit, because there is so few opportunities to launch into low inclination right now. So our ideal, you know, client would be interested in that particular kind of orbit and have a satellite which is essentially in a microsatellite form factor, which is under 100 kilograms.
Elon Musk's Starlink project was facing a little bit of criticism when it comes to darkening the skies for astronomy. Mm. There's a lot of talk about space debris. So how do you feel about bringing even more satellites, CubeSats, into orbit? Isn't that a problem for the entire industry?
Well, it will definitely be a challenge ahead. From our side, our market focus is actually on low Earth orbit, and orbital decay doesn't really leave much of a debris over extended periods of time, unless you have onboard orbital maintenance kind of propulsion setup. So we will not be adding that much problem to it. In fact, we are in contact with a couple of companies which are working on deorbiting solutions, and if we're to do our part, once we develop a slightly heavier launch system to cater to them, we will be more than happy to offer preferential rates for MEO satellite removal, especially for medium Earth orbit.
So I understood that correct. You were mentioning deorbiting solutions.
Yeah.
Deorbiting meaning controlled crash.
More like debris removal, because most of the upcoming satellites will end up having some sort of deorbiting capability by themselves in the end. I think it will end up, legislated. But what do we do with all this stuff which is already up there? That will require, essentially another spacecraft which docks itself to an existing satellite and slows it down until it re-enters the Earth's orbit.
Right. Even the European Space Agency, ESA, is investing quite a bit of money into solutions to remove space debris.
Yeah.
Because the thing is that this brings some existential risk to the entire industry.
Absolutely, yes.
Because space debris keeps multiplying and producing itself by collisions with itself. So that's a serious issue at
Absolutely,
the moment.
Yeah.
But I'm not telling you anything new here.
Yeah, so Kessler syndrome is a very, very valid concern. And every single time I meet anyone on any space tech conference, this topic pops up. How do we control this? How do we make sure it doesn't get out of control?
You mentioned that Kessler syndrome. Can you go into that very briefly again, what that is?
Yeah, so the idea of a Kessler syndrome is that if one collision between two satellites creates a couple of hundreds of thousands of pieces of additional debris, and then that debris, which is flying in slightly different directions because of the momentum conservation which is at play. So it flies in slightly different directions. And if that secondary debris starts to hit four satellites, and the four satellites say 16 satellites, and at some point you will basically start having this runaway chain reaction.
It's an exponential curve.
Exponential curve, and a chain reaction, which essentially dooms all of the telecommunications that we have that rely on satellites, and also prevent any further access into orbit for a very, very long time, if not forever. So that's it's definitely a huge problem, and we have to sort it out as an entire industry. That's for sure.
So humans keep on doing what they do best. They produce litter and debris. So what we are doing on Earth, we keep doing in space.
Yeah, we have to get our shit together. Pardon my French.
All right. Let's talk a little bit about the cargo itself. So what is it that customers usually want to achieve with their CubeSats, with their satellites? What kind of things, what kind of knowledge do they want to produce? What kind of businesses are they after?
Yeah. So essentially, there are two broad categories of commercial satellites. The ones built for communications, and there's a variety of different ways they can communicate. There could be providing satellite broadband. They could be providing very basic data service for IoT communications. They can be providing just normal, you know, UHF or VHF radio waves. So there's a variety of ways they can do it. And the importance of that is that we don't really get it when we live in cities, but actually vast majority of the planet is still left unconnected. And each time you log into your onboard internet when you're on an aircraft, I know it sounds a little surreal now to be talking about flying.
What was that again?
But every time you do that, it's actually going through a satellite. And the other thing which satellites are typically commercial satellites are basically used for is Earth observation, which can also come in many, you know, shapes and sizes and forms. It can be done with visible light, can be done with infrared, and can be done with synthetic aperture radars, which are completely impervious to weather and lighting conditions, because they actually, you know, it's essentially a visual radar scanner. And they basically let us know what's going on with the planet, whether it's the ecosystem or whether it's our supply chains or whether it's our oil fields, you know, which might be leaking and it's difficult to keep track of all of those pipes from the ground. So satellites are very versatile in that sense. And actually, a very important part of the entire industry right now is what do we do with all that data which is being streamed from satellites? How do we make sense out of it? So and of course, this does not include government initiatives such as navigation services, scientific satellites, and deep space payloads, which is a whole different story. But you know, let's just focus on the commercial side for now. The modern economy could not function without satellite data and communications right now. And basically, there's no turning back.
So, Simon, what do you think, what kind of new things will we be soon experiencing in our everyday lives?
Well, I think you'll be able to go to any place on this planet and connect to high-speed internet. And it will not just be from Starlink, because I think too many countries will want to have their own sovereign communications. And I think soon enough we'll see a near real-time Earth observation capability as well. So you'll be able to just log in some place and see exactly what's going on wherever you want to see it.
Did you just mention real-time?
I think we're actually getting, of course, not close just yet, but I think eventually we will. Another thing which I wanted to point out is there are some pretty crazy predictions as to the satellite numbers. We are far more conservative with our market analysis. I think we'll see maybe 6,000 to 7,000 individual satellites from non-mega constellations, which require, you know, a third-party launch service provider. But still, that is going to be a complete game changer for the way we communicate and understand our economy and our planet.
Wow. I mean, how many satellites are up in orbit at the moment? On average.
Yeah, I would have to look it up. I forgot the exact figure. But a couple of thousand, I believe.
You mentioned that there will be 6,000 new ones?
Oh, that's just from the non-mega constellations like Starlink. So wow. Altogether, I think we might see 20, 25. I think that's a realistic expectation.
I mean, you mentioned that there could be or will be global internet availability anytime soon. So what does that mean for the telecom companies? I mean, will they will need to search for new business models,
okay,
right?
I am not an expert in telecoms, so I can only offer a very, you know, rudimentary guess. But I think there will be a competition between the two of those, regarding cost, coverage, quality, and all that, and speed, of course. So I think there will be different niches for different services. I think if you're in the middle of a city, it will just still be more practical scale-wise to connect to your 5G, terrestrial 5G. But if you're, let's say, in a farmland somewhere in rural Indonesia, where nobody built a fiber network yet, I think it will actually become cheaper to just connect to a satellite rather than build terrestrial infrastructure. So I think that I think those two will really complement each other.
Simon, we're slowly and gradually getting to the end of our show. We do have a fun tradition here on Space Cafe podcast. We call it Space Espresso.
Okay.
Because, of course, you might want to have a little bit of an espresso when you go into coffee places. So what kind of story, what kind of thought, what kind of idea comes into your mind when you think about space? So what's the coolest story you would like to share with us right
now? Wow. Well, you know, aside from me kind of wanting to go to space, especially now when there's not much left to do on Earth. Yeah. Well, that's actually a really good question. You know what? Last year I was at this event in Bangkok. Not sure if you're familiar with SGAC, Space Generation Advisory Council.
That's already a good beginning.
So, okay, yeah. So essentially, it's a youth groups, and I was there mostly to network and meet fellow space geeks, and also do some business in Bangkok at the same time. Nothing funny, just pure business. And I was talking to all those people, and the next day I visited the Thai Space Agency, the headquarters, and they had this entire collage of drawings made by school kids, and they were all picturing themselves in spacesuits. You know, and at that point I was like, a little tear falling out of my eye, and it's like, those kids don't currently have the means to participate in any astronaut corps. There is none in Southeast Asia. No one wants to talk to anyone in this region about launching human beings at this point. Malaysia was the only one, I believe. I believe Indonesia was close to doing that with the Americans. But again, we kind of need to be on this, to do this ourselves anyway. If we are to be a spacefaring region and have this future ahead of us, I think it's important that if our future generations here are supposed to get this capability and get this whole universe of opportunities which comes from spaceflight, we really have to start now. And I think this story of meeting those people who are not ordinarily working with me and they have the exact same passion and drive and desire is what really shows how global our space dream is. I think it's pretty crazy that so few nations currently can actually launch human beings into space. I think it's something we have to work on changing. And if we are to realistically have representation in space and diversity in space, really, we must get to work right now, and we have to build this entire capability, this entire not just satellite development capability, but also launch life support systems and any way we can realistically contribute and possibly innovate and even outdo the existing players in the field.
Dear listeners, you just heard what Simon said, so please move your butts and go into the space industry. They need you.
Absolutely. We always need talent. We absolutely. Please join us.
Dear listeners, thank you so much for staying with us. Thank you, Simon, so much for your expertise.
Thank you for having me. My pleasure.
And your time. It was a very inspiring conversation with you.
Thank you.
Dear listeners, again, this is Space Cafe Podcast, and our base is Spacewatch Global. Wherever you are, you can look us up on the internet. If you want to learn more about Simon and Equatorial Space Systems, please do go to Spacewatch Global. And if you have a great story to tell, if you have something you want to share with us when it comes to space, please do send us a message to Spacewatch Global. There's a bunch of possibilities how you can get in contact with us. And Simon, thank you so much again for taking the time.
Sure thing.
And dear listeners, have a great time. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.